This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 8th of May, 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's show, we'll be live with John Owen and Matthew Jameson to review the day's top news stories, from political instability in Nigeria and Syria to media controversies in Australia.
The Prime Minister's election promise to not touch ABC funding has seemed increasingly unlikely since he openly accused the broadcaster of lacking affection for the home team earlier this year. But one can't help feel that Abbott has taken a short-sighted view of what Australia Network communicates to the world.
Then we are in Toronto to chat with our correspondent about all the latest Rob Ford news. And yes, it is Eurovision time. Our resident Eurovision editor Fernando Augusto Pacheco is in Copenhagen with a report on tonight's second semi-final.
And we also have the return of Poland, which have been absent from the show since 2011. Singer Donatan and Cleo might entertain the audience with some Polish hip-hop.
All that plus we talk books with our culture editor Rob Bound, and we play a bit of music too. That is coming up on Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, starting right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News with Jonathan Wheatley. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that the Ukrainian crisis was a result of, as he put it, irresponsible politics, and that an equal dialogue between Kiev and separatists in the southeast of the country would be key to easing tensions. On Wednesday, he called on rebels in eastern Ukraine to delay a vote on independence and said that Moscow had withdrawn troops from the border, but NATO and the US have questioned that. Meanwhile, an initial agreement's been reached which would make it easier for the European Union to target Russian companies with sanctions. Well, British Foreign Secretary William Hague said the move needs formal backing during the next meeting of EU foreign ministers this Monday.
As far as we are aware, there remain large Russian forces near the eastern borders of Ukraine. Of course, we have called for the pulling back of such forces as part of reducing tensions. So we hope that will take place, but we haven't seen signs of that so far.
Syrian forces have taken full control on Thursday over Homs, a city once associated with scenes of joyous pro-democracy crowds, but now famed for images of ruin that epitomise the brutality of Syria's civil war. After holding the old city of Homs for nearly 2 years, around 1,200 rebel fighters and trapped civilians boarded buses which took them out of the capital of the revolution in convoys. They were driven to rebel-held territory outside the city under a deal agreed between the insurgents and forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad. There have been more protests in Nigeria over the government's handling of the mass abduction of Boko Haram of schoolgirls. It's 3 weeks since more than 200 girls were taken in Borno State, with the militant group threatening to sell them into slavery. Meanwhile, officials say as many as 300 people may have died in the latest attack on a village in the northeast of Nigeria. Well, James Schneider is editor-in-chief of the think tank of the Think Africa Press. He said that the militants, though, could be losing some of the local support they had.
Nigerian military, the police tend to just do these mass roundups and just stick people in prisons, which has to date kind of helped draw people to Boko Haram. That may be less of a problem now, because Boko Haram, by turning so violently against the local population where they are, now the violence seems so kind of indiscriminate and generalised that I think they've rather undermined any possible support base they had.
Meanwhile, the Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has pledged to find the schoolgirls as the hostage crisis overshadows his opening address to the World Economic Forum. In Paris, the French President François Hollande laid a wreath today to mark the 69th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day. In a ceremony at the Arc de Triomphe, Hollande commemorated the anniversary of the end of the Second World War and the surrender of Nazi forces on the 8th of May 1945. The US President Barack Obama has accepted a humanitarian award from the Hollywood film director Steven Spielberg. At a special event which was held at the University of Southern California in a Holocaust museum funded by Spielberg after he made the film Schindler's List, Obama used his acceptance speech to express concern about conflicts and terrorist actions around the world.
And we only need to look at today's headlines. The devastation of Syria, the murders and kidnappings in Nigeria, the sectarian conflict, the tribal conflicts, to see that we have not yet extinguished man's darkest impulses. There are some bad stories out there that are being told.
And finally, staying in the United States, a 90-year-old man who admitted serving as a cocaine courier for a Mexican drug cartel has been sentenced to 3 years in a federal prison. Leo Sharp from Indiana, a decorated World War II combat veteran, was also sentenced to 3 years supervised release by a judge at a court in Detroit. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you. That was Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news, and Jonathan will be back with even more in 24 minutes. Meanwhile, you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we are back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University London and Chairman of the Frontline Club, and Matthew Jameson, a Consultant Fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start in Nigeria, where the country's leader, President Goodluck Jonathan, has said that the abduction of more than 200 Nigerian girls by Boko Haram could be a turning point in the battle against Islamist militants. John, you have been to Northeast Nigeria, American University of Nigeria, which is in Boko Haram territory. What did you see over there and what was the atmosphere like?
Well, it was several years ago, but they were greatly concerned about attacks by Boko Haram. There'd been one in Yola, which is the nearest community to the university. And I was exchanging emails today with the man who runs security for the American University of Nigeria. The whole campus, by the way, owned and created by a former vice president of Nigeria who happened to be the customs head for many years. Again, getting to how you make money in Nigeria. But the director told me that so far, so good. But he would say that because he has 400 security officers who ring the entire campus. So I think they're lucky and spared so far. But the issue there, as it is a little farther north in Borno, where all this is taking place, is it's so close to the Cameroon border. In fact, Yola used to be part of Cameroon, so it's so easy to slip in through this dense forest into Cameroon, and that's obviously where these guys have taken these young women.
And Matthew, if I come to you next, what is your view? Indeed, as I said, President Goodluck Jonathan has said that these recent kidnappings could mark a turning point when it comes to fight against militants over there. Do you think there's any reason to think so?
I hope so. I certainly am very encouraged by the worldwide campaign that's now taken off, even though this story is actually quite old. It occurred about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we're only finally in the West starting to pay attention to it now, which is good. I mean, it's unconscionable. It's absolutely outrageous. Education is a fundamental, basic human right, and to target innocent girls who are simply trying to get educated is just, it goes beyond, sort of a perversion, really. And I think it has been so outrageous that actually you're even seeing elements within Al-Qaeda trying to distance themselves from it, because it's just a really spectacular end goal in the sense that it shows just how warped this whole ideology is. So you may actually see a real backlash now against this more extreme militancy.
John, do you agree with that?
I don't know, because it gets to failure of leadership within Nigeria. And I found a quote today from that wonderful Nigerian writer, Chinua Achebe. And he wrote a little book in 1977 called The Image of Africa. And he said the problem in Africa and problem in Nigeria is nothing to do with the character of the Nigerian people or the water or the air. It is a failure of political leadership. They don't rise to the occasion. Now, we've had a month for good luck, Jonathan, to do something about this. He's done nothing. Watching him today was, I thought, just he was feckless. Just, we're now getting help. We're in the midst of trying to rescue these young women. I doubt if the Nigerians under his leadership will pull this off.
So what exactly would you want Jonathan, good luck, Jonathan, to actually do? What would actually make you more convinced that he's actually able to do something positive to the situation?
Well, again, when we get in the middle of these crises, obviously whatever is necessary to get the girls out safely and return them to their families is what we want. And how that's done, we don't much care as long as we spare the lives of these young women. And by the way, it's a war crime, what they're doing. They can be held accountable for committing a war crime. But we have to spool back, because what we never get in the reporting is what has been going on in Nigeria. It's badly divided for decades, north, south. The guys who became Boko Haram felt that they were terribly treated as Muslims in the north by the largely dominated Christian government. So there is a historical context, no justification for their terrorism. But, you know, again, there needs to be pan-Nigerian leadership, as we had from someone called Nelson Mandela.
And as Matthew just mentioned, even some people from Al-Qaeda are distancing themselves from Boko Haram now, followed by these recent events. Do you think Boko Haram is actually facing some kind of backlash now?
I think, Matthew, you're probably better aimed at... I have no idea. All I know is this may have been a act of terrorism too far. You would have thought someone would have been smart enough to say, the one thing we don't want to do is create an international social media campaign against us, the same way that was launched against Joseph Kony, which, by the way, has not resulted in him being found or him being stopped. So I don't know. I have no idea, really. It really depends on whether or not there will be some kind of final, desperate political consensus to try to solve this problem.
Well, let's move now to Ukraine. Vladimir Putin, Russian president, has asked rebels in the east of Ukraine to postpone a secession vote. But the rebels have ignored that request, and they say that they are going to push ahead with that vote. Does this mean that the rebels really are not under anyone's control?
Well, that's a very good question, actually. And I've been pondering that all day, because on the surface, it would appear that the rebels really are, you know, very much doing what they like, in the sense that they're not completely under the thumb and control of the Kremlin. However, you have to scratch beneath the surface on this, because it is such a complex geopolitical situation. I wouldn't be surprised if Putin had actually coordinated his announcement yesterday about wanting these referendums put back with the pro-Russian forces in these areas. And then, you know, it's all staged, because then they can come out and say, well, actually, you know, we're going to do what we want. And then Putin can say, well, at least I tried. You know, I'm trying to sort of bring things down. But quite frankly, the situation is now verging on civil war.
Well, I think that's an interesting take on this. And I sort of am where you are on this. I think we should, though, again, keep in mind, and the Pew polls reinforce the fact that still, and these polls were taken before Odessa, in which the pro-Ukrainians set alight that building and killed more than 30 pro-Russians, and that could have also driven now public opinion. But all the polls overwhelmingly, obviously more in the West than in the East, still show they want a united Ukraine. So beyond the sound bites, beyond the characters dominating our TV screens, and beyond the punditry, the fact is the country still wants to stay together.
Yes.
And maybe Putin knows that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting looking at what these rebels want now. They want a vote, and they're going to push ahead with a vote. But what about if the result is that people actually want to stay indeed as part of Ukraine?
I don't think they would let that, you know, inconvenience them and get in the way, quite frankly. Because, I mean, this whole exercise is a farce. And, you know, it's a cock and bull story, and everybody around the world knows that. There is absolutely no democratic legitimacy in these so-called referenda. And it is it's a farce, and it's a complete, I think, it is a total stage-managed operation from the Kremlin. And or either, you know, it was certainly in the beginning, and now they've let the genie so far out of the bottle that they actually, the events have just gotten so out of control.
Can I just ask from you, if you think that this all is so constant, so orchestrated and organised by Kremlin, why does Putin every now and then claim that the Russian forces have been moved away from Ukrainian border when, you know, all the Western forces can easily check the situation and they can see that that hasn't happened?
Oh, yes, of course. But you must remember it's a propaganda battle, and the public can't sort of easily check, you know, like the military can, whether or not, you know, these forces have been pulled back. So it's a useful tactic in terms of the media, public opinion, propaganda campaign that's going on for Putin to come out with these little statements here and there to make himself seem reasonable. But actually, it's just a diversionary and confusing tactic.
Also, we shouldn't forget that those sanctions are starting to bite. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Russian economy is powered by a certain growth rate, I think over 4%. Mm-hmm. They're not going to make that. If the price of oil dips below $100, the Russian economy and Putin are in trouble, and he can't deliver all of those wonderful reforms that he keeps mm-hmm. promising and in the modernizing of Russia. And mm-hmm. so all of the people around him are now being put on that list they can't travel. That also has to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before the break, let's cross to Syria, where the rebels have detonated a huge bomb underneath an Aleppo hotel used by President Bashar al-Assad's forces. And elsewhere in the news, it is also reported that rebel fighters have completed their withdrawal from the central city of Homs. What do you think? What is the significance of this story? Is the situation in Syria changing now?
It's very, very difficult to say because recently it looks as if the regime was gaining the upper hand and it was actually reasserting control. And I would have said that, you know, we're looking very much at a stalemate. I still think that it's going to be a stalemate. I still think we're going to see a war of attrition. Perhaps this signifies that the rebels are, you know, wanting to push back. But it's just a terrible, terrible situation with really no end in sight.
Well, I tend to look at the media and journalism of all this because that's what I know best. All I know is Homs was where one of the best correspondents in the world, Marie Colvin, lost her life, thinking that her reporting about what was going on the ground would lead to an international response to Syria and stop it. We know what has happened. But what has happened is journalists are not on the ground. So we sit here, we're only as good as whatever YouTube videos are being posted about, for example, the rebels blowing up the Syrian building inside Aleppo. We see that the rebels now are regrouping, but we don't have any real information. And that is where the terrible price, the loss of life of reporters and journalism has made us ignorant about what's going on.
It is indeed a sad story. France has reportedly written a resolution in the hopes of referring civil war-torn Syria to the International Criminal Court. The resolution is currently in draft form, but could circulate among the 15 delegations on the Security Council next week. Could you see this happening, Syria in the International Criminal Court?
Oh, it must. Absolutely. I mean, the Assad regime has carried out some of the most barbaric, unbelievable crimes against humanity on its own people. I mean, children as young as 7 have been rounded up and tortured. Hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered. Barrel bombs, crude barrels with all kinds of nasty things in them and ammunition and so on, have been used in residential areas. Barrel bombs just thrown out of helicopters into people's homes where children have been eating. I mean, it has been indiscriminate slaughter against its civilian population that the Assad regime has carried out. And they must be held accountable. And Assad must be held accountable. So I think it's a brilliant move that France is doing. We need all these moves. Whether it will happen or not, who knows? Russia, you know, has been protecting the Assad regime and will go on protecting it probably until the dying day of it. But we must try as much as possible to bring these brutal criminals to account.
How many obstacles are there in the way? You mentioned Russia there already. Is this a realistic idea?
Well, I mean, you know, people would have said Slobodan Milosevic in The Hague was an unrealistic idea. And we got there in the end. And, you know, whether or not one agrees with how Saddam Hussein met his fate or Colonel Gaddafi, I mean, some people would say justice was served there. Personally, I feel as though, you know, you have to have it in a court of law. So we had Milosevic, and I think we've got to try to get Assad.
But, you know, those who are critical of American and British conduct in Iraq and other places would say, of course, that you'll never see anybody from the West because they're not signatories to the International Criminal Court. So only the African leaders and the deposed other bad guys end up there. That's one of the real problems.
Let's continue with a short break. Now, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Marcus Hippie, John Owen and Matthew Jameson. And they will be still here when we come back from the break. And up next, we'll head to Australia. And then we will drag up a name that you probably haven't heard in at least a few weeks, Edward Snowden. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University London and Chairman of the Frontline Club, and Matthew Jameson, a consultant fellow at the London-based think tank RUSI. Let's look to Germany now, where lawmakers want to quiz American whistleblower and ostensible fugitive Edward Snowden. This would be a part of a parliamentary inquiry into the mass surveillance of German citizens, which Snowden himself exposed. It has not yet been decided whether Snowden should be invited to testify in person about the NSA surveillance that has soured ties between Washington and Berlin. John, I guess we are talking about how the way media works, but we haven't heard of Edward Snowden for a while. How much do we actually know about how he's doing in Russia?
We don't. I do commend that long piece in Vanity Fair about him, though. It's fascinating. What's the German word for potato? I mean, this is a...
Kartoffel.
Well, that's what it is. It's a German hut. Kartoffel. Because obviously, he would love to get to Berlin. I mean, that's where he would like to be. That's where all of the attempts have taken place. But I don't think Merkel wants to take that one on. Do you? I don't.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think she would be very stupid to do so because it would be a red rag to a bull. Mr. Snowden has presided over probably one of the greatest intelligence leaks in American history and also in British history. I don't believe personally that he was doing this all for the benefit of everybody off his own back, and he was just working by himself. I think that what he did went way beyond his technical capabilities, way beyond. After all, he was just a mid-level sort of contractor, and he didn't have that ability to hack in and the equipment and all those sorts of things. He had help, and I personally think he was probably working with the FSB, or he had become manipulated by Russian intelligence. Why did he go to China? I mean, Hong Kong, China. Mm-hmm. And then why did he go to China, first of all? And then a very, very repressive authoritarian regime. And then he went to Moscow, another very, very oppressive authoritarian regime, which has an appalling human rights record. And I wonder what they do domestically in terms of their surveillance. Of course, he called in to a phone
conversation with Mr. Putin just a few weeks ago and asked him what the Russian domestic intelligence surveillance system was like. And of course, that provided President Putin with the opportunity to say, oh, it's not as intrusive as the American one. So, Mr. Snowden, I don't think it would be wise for the German MPs to have him in Berlin because the Obama administration would really not look kindly on that.
Looking at the options Mr. Snowden has at the moment, do you think he will spend the rest of his life in Russia?
No. I think there'll be a deal, and eventually I think he'll be brought back. I predict, well, depending upon who wins the White House the next time around. But I can see a scenario in which he will be brought back and there will be some minimal sentence served. That's what I think, based on no information other than a hunch. But I would also must say, Matthew, that that scenario you have for what happened to him, I'd like to read that story because no one else has put those destinations together in quite that way. I hope you've got some sources on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just myself. I mean, a lot of people have said that really, actually, it's not possible that he could have done this all by himself. It's just, I mean, it's not credible.
You know, you mentioned where is Edward Snowden? The other question is, really, he's completely eclipsed Julian Assange. Mm. You'll almost never hear anything about Assange. Indeed. Must be driving him crazy.
Absolutely.
Sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy.
But, you know, there's one more story I'd like to talk about with you. So let's move forward. Let's end on some media news from down under. The ABC in Australia will lose its $223 million Australian network contract next week. John and Matthew will come to you in a moment. But first, we asked our Melbourne correspondent for his thoughts. Here is Adrian Craddock.
If you're an Australian rules football fan living in Sri Lanka, I'm afraid I have bad news. A Perth newspaper today reported that the Abbott government is planning to cut Australia Network, the state-run TV service that broadcasts throughout the Asia Pacific. The channel was originally conceived in 1993 as a way of promoting Australian values and diplomacy abroad. Though in recent times, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has accused the station of departing from its charter. Along with the rest of the ABC, Australian Network pulled no punches in its reporting of the Indonesian spying scandal and the tensions surrounding Abbott's strict asylum policy. It didn't go unnoticed. The Prime Minister's election promise to not touch ABC funding has seemed increasingly unlikely since he openly accused the broadcaster of lacking affection for the home team earlier this year. But one can't help feel that Abbott has taken a short-sighted view of what Australia Network communicates to the world. As broadcasters such as Russia Today have proved, state-funded news sources live or die by their reputation for independence. More importantly, balanced political criticism, however uncomfortable it is for Bishop and Abbott, projects an image that perfectly aligns with the channel's original charter. What's more Australian than having an open debate about sensitive government issues without the fear of violence or intervention? Despite having one of the smallest national debts in the developed world, the Australian Treasury will presumably put the decision down to its so-called budget crisis. What's more worrying is Julie Bishop's cost-saving alternative. She's already flagged social media as a more economic method of furthering the country's soft power. Surely communicating Australian values will require more than 140 characters. For Monocle in Melbourne, I'm Adrian Craddock.
John, what is your initial reaction? Are we going to be missing much without Australia Network?
Well, I think Australians are, as the piece pointed out. And somewhere, don't you think the hand of Rupert Murdoch and his family is there? Because Sky definitely wanted that contract. They lost it out. And now this is kind of a sweet opportunity for revenge by the new government. But I think it really is a death blow for public service broadcasting. That's a terrible loss. Just think about if the BBC World Service had lost its foreign service grant, and then also the government said, by the way, you're getting no more money. So you would have taken a complete loss of the BBC. They wouldn't have been able to finance it. So this is a catastrophic blow for public service broadcasting, I think.
What Adrian Craddock mentioned over there a second minute ago was Russia Today RT, which has got a fair bit of visibility, partly because of what's going on in Ukraine. Do you think in this kind of moments we actually realize that we need this kind of services?
And your own piece in Monocle points out what has happened to Russia today. And by the way, I was going to make the point earlier in Ukraine, the head of RT was one of those given a medal by Vladimir Putin for distinguished media coverage of the Ukraine crisis. But yes, you want a public service broadcaster that is able also to use all kinds of resources to reach throughout the region. And I again, it's just a political blowback, I think. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, I completely agree with John. I think that public broadcasting is so important and it has such an important role to play. It's really, really sad that this has become so politicized and partisan, and that the Abbott government had decided to do this. Like you said about the BBC World Service, it would just be dire if something like that happened. So I completely agree with John's views on that.
And we're going to leave it there. John Owen from City University London and chairman of the Frontline Club, and Matthew Jameson from RUSI, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there is plenty more to come on the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Toronto. We will head to the second semi-final of Eurovision, and we will talk books with our culture editor, Robert Bound. But before we get started on all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the World News headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that the Ukrainian crisis was a result of, as he put it, irresponsible politics, and that an equal dialogue between Kiev and separatists in the southeast of the country would be key to easing tensions. Syrian forces have taken full control on Thursday over Homs, a city once associated with scenes of joyous pro-democracy crowds, but now famed for images of ruin that epitomise the brutality of Syria's civil war. After holding the old city of Homs for nearly 2 years, around 1,200 rebel fighters and civilians boarded buses which took them out of the capital of the revolution in convoys. There have been more protests in Nigeria over the government's handling of the mass abduction by Boko Haram of schoolgirls. It's 3 weeks since more than 200 girls were taken in Borno State, with the militant group threatening to sell them into slavery. And in Paris, the French President François Hollande has laid a wreath today to mark the 69th anniversary of VE, or Victory in Europe Day. In a ceremony at the Arc de Triomphe, Hollande commemorated the anniversary of the end of the Second World War and the surrender of Nazi forces on the 8th of May 1945. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Today we head to Toronto, where Monocle correspondent Chris Frey is waiting for this day's biggest news. Hello, Chris, and welcome to the programme. Shall we start straight away with Prime Minister Harper, who has been picking a fight with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court? What exactly is going on over there?
Yeah, it's fairly unprecedented. I mean, governments taking issue with decisions from the top court is certainly nothing new. But there has been a recent string of judgments on constitutional matters, five consecutive ones, in fact, that have not gone in the government's favor. And so quite unexpectedly, you know, there have been past attempts, whether it's Prime Minister Trudeau or Brian Mulroney, where, of course, you know, they disagreed with the court's ruling. But, I mean, they didn't go so far as to, like, personally attack or impugn the integrity of any of the justices, particularly the Chief Justice. So what we're seeing now is a bit unprecedented. And, of course, you know, the Prime Minister and the Justice Minister are playing a little fast and loose with the rules. They have essentially suggested that in one of the decisions that they just handed down, that Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin inappropriately contacted the Prime Minister's office and the Justice Minister to sort of advise them about on the issue, which, I mean, if that actually was a file that she knew that was going to be coming before the court, then yes, she would have been intervening or acting inappropriately. But in fact, nothing of the sort happened, and actually any sort of communication she had was entirely within the bounds of convention, and it was not on a file that necessarily she knew for certain was going to be coming before her desk. So you know, the government has been criticized for this quite widely. I haven't seen anybody really come to its defense on this one, even like the past 11 presidents of the Canadian Bar Association. And they haven't really addressed the way the government hasn't, the way in which it's played a little fast and loose with these allegations. I mean, this is a government that has a reputation for building an enemies list, for the attacking the integrity of other critics. There has been the suggestion that perhaps this is really an attempt to rally its base in the face of an election a year from now, and it's been struggling in the polls and hasn't really found that rallying issue to sort of band the base together. So, you know, people are just kind of, you know, a little shocked at sort of what's happened. But I think the only explanation is maybe there's something really quite, you know, purposeful about this, that they are making a political gesture.
What do you think? How is this going to affect Prime Minister Harper's popularity?
I don't know. He's not really a personally popular man in the first place. I think even the people who vote for him really are voting for him on principle and on policy. They may admire him in some respects, but he's not the warmest gentleman. He's not the most charismatic gentleman. And in fact, I mean, his party, we're looking at a three-party system. So it's, you know, winning a majority government, which the Conservatives did do a couple of years ago, is more a function of math and how sort of our parliamentary, you know, representational democracy works. He has been behind in the polls, behind the Liberals and the young Justin Trudeau for the past year or two. So I think, you know, as they look ahead to an election a little over a year from now, there probably is some anxiety in the Conservative ranks, but I think a move like this only reinforces people's perception that Harper is paranoid and a little out of touch with reality.
Well, Chris, there's a new list now, a new ranking list of good government, and Canada has been slipping on that list. How much is Prime Minister Harper to be blamed for this?
I think entirely. This is a global ranking of sustainable governance that was released just a few days ago by the Bertelsmann Foundation. Or in fact, I think it was released just this morning. And Canada has slipped quite a bit. I think in overall policy performance, it's now 20th out of 41 developed countries. And particularly in certain areas like the quality of its democracy, where it's 17th, and on environmental policies, where Canada ranked almost last out of the 41 countries. And the report does go on to say that this slip has coincided with the Conservatives gaining a majority government in 2011. It explicitly says that and points to issues like the open hostility it's shown towards certain you know, people, I guess, who would be holding the government to account, like the parliamentary budget officer, who is impartial and reports on government budget matters, government scientists who may say things or, you know, release findings that contradict the government's own, you know, I guess, goals on environmental policy, obviously critical of the government's policies, anything that casts the government in a bad light, and even the access to information laws are becoming more strict. So in all these different levels, we're seeing this slide, and they're pointing directly at the Harper government.
Do you think this kind of a ranking list can actually have practical consequences and implications? Do you think it really matters for Canada that Canada has been slipping on that list?
I think it will matter. It'll be one more arrow in the quiver, I think, for critics of the government, for whom this is just, you know, further confirmation of all or very much of the many of the qualities they'd ascribe to Harper and his style of government, you know, tightly centralized control, not just on his, you know, members of parliament and staff, but just purely on the flow of information. A lot of image building and not a lot of debate allowed on issues, and even their propensity to sort of stick what might seem to be, you know, lower to moderate kind of policy issues into like larger omnibus bills. So, you know, they're sort of sneaking in laws that otherwise they wouldn't have to, so they don't have to debate them in front of Parliament. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to change their vote in the upcoming election, but you would have to think at some point with an election a year from now, that Harper does need to have some positive stories to tell, and this doesn't help.
Well, Chris, I think the fact is that when we do a Toronto check-in, we can't do one without asking what's the latest in the case Rob Ford.
Yeah, well, just when he supposedly had gone away, last week, as you probably know, he finally announced that he was going to go into rehab for only 30 days, he indicated, and suspend his reelection campaign. And obviously, he won't be appearing in the mayor's chair for the next little while. So this was last Tuesday or Wednesday, and this just coinciding with some new audio and video that, again, does not show the mayor in a flattering light. On Thursday, he left town, or he was supposed to have left town. And there are reports that when he arrived in Chicago, that he did not actually end up entering the United States, that in the, I think in the gentle language that was used, he withdrew his application to enter the United States, which sounds as though he met some trouble at the border, and then rather trying to resolve it then and there, he just thought he'd spare himself the embarrassment and come back to Canada. We're not sure where he is. It's quite strange. Yesterday, he made a phone call to some local media just to tell him how great he was doing. He said, quote, "Rehab is amazing. It was like the football camp he went to as a kid." He indicated that he was actually doing some work while in rehab and calling constituents, which seems a little bizarre for somebody who should be focusing on, you know, the issues at hand when they're in rehab and sort of putting work aside. And yet there have also been actual Rob Ford sightings around town. People who say or have tweeted that they, for example, saw him at a local Tim Hortons coffee chain the other day. So everybody's quite confused what the mayor is up to. If he is legitimately in rehab, I think everybody would be happy to know that. But the fact that he's sort of making these, you know, strange peripheral appearances has people worried that, you know, once again, whether or not he's lying to people about his true intentions or what he's actually up to.
Chris Frey in Toronto. And up next, we'll head to Copenhagen for the latest update with our Eurovision editor, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Stay tuned.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. It is 1941 in Copenhagen, 1841 in London, and 1341 in New York City. The second semi-final of Eurovision takes place tonight in Copenhagen. We already found out the first 10 nations who are going to the final on Tuesday on the first semi-final. Bookies' favourites, the Armenian and Swedish entries, are already classified. But worry not, there is much excitement for today's semi-final, including a certain bearded Austrian drag queen. Our Eurovision editor Fernando Augusto Pacheco prepared a little guide for today's performances.
Today is the second semi-final for the Eurovision Song Contest here in Copenhagen. We've seen favorites Sweden and Armenia classify with 8 other countries on Tuesday, but now we have 15 other nations competing for a place in the final. Okay, we might have seen the powerful ballads of Aaron MP3 from Armenia and Sanna Nielsen from Sweden, but this Thursday we'll hear from the biggest star of them all, the bearded Austrian drag queen, which have been dominating the headlines. Her song, Rise Like a Phoenix, is a classy James Bond-esque tune, a Latina Turner's golden eye. Her looks and powerful presence might be a winner. This is Conchita Wurst.
From the fading light of you're my flame.
And we also have the return of Poland, which have been absent from the show since 2011. Singer Donatan and Cleo might entertain the audience with some Polish hip-hop. It seems that another little Eurovision trend this year are songs influenced by country music. We had on Tuesday the sensible country of the Dutch entry, The Common Linnets. But today we have Malta with singer Fireflight with Coming Home. Mind you, listeners, that's a more Garth Brooks kind of country.
Freedom of life, I will express my soul. Look me in the eye and electrify my bones. I ain't gonna leave until you know my name. Stepping out of the shell, now don't you step in my way. Build another wall and watch it crumble by your side.
Going against the trend for ballads this year, we have the Macedonian entry with Tijana. The song To the Sky can be described as the sort of song you would be listening in a packed dance floor at 2 a.m. after a couple of drinks. Expect shirtless man in her performance. And to end on a soothing note, we have the Norwegian entry this year. Carl Espen is one of the bookie's favorite with Silent Storm and could possibly bring the title back to Norway with this emotional track. Enjoy the semifinals today and let the best one win. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Indeed, that was our Eurovision editor, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, there. Let's continue with a bit of music. We just heard a bit of Poland's entry. Let's hear the track in full. This is Maj Słowiani with We Are Slavic.
Yeah! makes us proud of our natural shapes. On our lines, you have everything you need. So pour the vodka straight, no need to mix. Cream and butter taste so good. We prepare for you delicious food. Our beauty's famous all over the world. You gotta see it for yourself and then you will know. We're slimy girls, we know how to use our charming beauty. Now shake what your mama gave ya. Clap your hands to this music. This is our nature, this is our core. This is our hot, slimy boy. We're slimy girls, we know how to use our charming beauty. Now shake what your mama gave ya. Clap your hands to this music.
Wow, that was Poland's Eurovision entry Maj Słowiany with We Are Slavic. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's time for the review segment of today's program. And today we talk books, and I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound.
Hello, hi, Marcus.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
So you've got three books for us, and I take it that they are good books, as you have
they are
them
good
for us.
They are good books. I could bring some not good books in, some bad books. But no, let's go through a couple actually that are in this new edition, this new issue of Monocle. I don't think it's in shops now, but it will be next week.
It's going to be in shops shortly.
We can plot spoil slightly here. But I want to tell you first about a book that that we didn't manage to squeeze in to the magazine, but which I'm slightly annoyed about because it is an amazing novel, one of the best novels I've read in a while. It's called The Ballad of a Small Player by Lawrence Osborne.
And what is it all about?
This is about a man called Lord Doyle, and it's written in the first person. Lord Doyle spends his time trying to bankrupt himself in the casinos, the seedy casinos of Macau. And it's set in the current time. Lord Doyle is a sort of unreliable narrator who, as I say, you think you don't quite know who he is, and it's sort of the truth seeps through the novel that he's basically a guy whose father was a double glazing salesman or something in Sussex, and he becomes a solicitor and he defrauds an old lady of her considerable wealth on her deathbed. And then takes all the money and runs literally to Macau and decides, not necessarily out of guilt, you never really know, but he decides to basically sort of drink and gamble himself
to
an early grave.
So he's really trying to get rid of his money.
So he's trying to sort of get rid of this money, but there's a strange thing happens. I don't want to spoil this for listeners because I genuinely would urge people to buy this book. It's absolutely fantastic. He gets on an uncanny winning streak. He also comes across some interesting people sort of meet his path, and you're not quite sure whether it's real or what's happening and whether it's fake. It's a very ethereal novel that riffs on the Taoist belief, and the Buddhist belief rather, of the Guailo, the white ghost, which all Westerners in Macau or in Hong Kong especially are considered. So you never quite know if he exists or not, but it's written thrillingly, almost like a thriller, but very personal and very strange.
Where do you think the beauty of this novel lies? What is it that you like about it so much?
It's a beautiful novel to inhabit. It's an intensely pleasurable novel to inhabit, if you know what I mean. You know, you have that thing where you just wish it was another 100 pages, another 200 pages long. The writing itself is beautiful. He's a wonderful writer. He's actually a travel writer as well as he is a novelist. He wrote a wonderful book called The Forgiven a couple of years ago, and this is a whole different sort of thing to that. But he's an itinerant writer, and he's lived in New York. He lives in Bangkok at the moment, so he knows the sort of, you get a feeling that he knows the flesh pots and the gambling dens of the United States and of Asia and of Europe, and he is fictionalizing them perhaps and stylizing them and putting some sort of psychedelic touches on them.
That sounds really good, and that's your first recommendation.
That's a really wonderful book, The Ballad of a Small Player by Lawrence Osborne.
I wonder if the next book is slightly more serious. We're talking about an autobiography here.
Yeah, this is called An Encyclopedia of Myself. It's by Jonathan Meads. Jonathan Meads is the most fantastic the most fantastic writer. He was the restaurant critic of the London Times when I was a kid, and he was the reason I wanted to be a writer and a critic of any sort myself, or a broadcaster of any sort myself.
He must be in his 60s or 70s at the moment.
Yeah, he's in his 60s. I think he's in his 60s. And he's an architecture critic. He makes amazing programmes for the BBC, perhaps one of the few reasons why you should still buy a licence fee for Jonathan Mead's amazing documentaries on the BBC. Anyway, he's also, of course, an amazing writer. He was brought up in rural England in a county called Wiltshire, and he had a sort of, you know, the 1950s in England are thought to be are stereotypically grey. You know, they're boring. This is after the war. There was rationing. There was nothing to do, especially if you lived in the countryside, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Mead paints this amazing sort of Jackson Pollock-like bright picture, this kind of slightly surreal psychedelic picture of growing up in the 1950s, where packaging was crazy, where the cast of characters that populate this sort of semi-rural idyll that he grew up in are all crazy. Don't forget, it was also the era of the Cold War, so there was all this sort of strange paranoia. There was all sorts of strange broadcasting, strange stories. People that worked at military bases and RAF bases in England and brought strange things back from abroad and all the rest of it. And it all goes into this sort of huge melting pot. And his writing style, he is a man that has waged 40 years of war against cliche. And this book is an amazing sort of, I guess, digest of the early years of his life. It just goes up until he's sort of 18 and he moves to London. He moves in with some strange people there, but it's absolutely fantastic.
Do you ever get the thing when you, I don't want to sound a big headed, but sometimes when I read people's autobiographies, I kind of find myself reflecting my own life to their lives. Did you have the same process when you were reading this?
Yeah, you do. Well, especially when they're sort of heroes of yours. You go, when he was this age, he liked this, and so did I. So we're all wonderful. Aren't we wonderful together sort of thing? There is a bit of that, Marcus. I mean, we're calling it an autobiography. It's sort of, I'd call it maybe memoir. I don't want to split hairs with you, but there is a different quality to it. It is a very subjective. It's a telling of stories, more about the cast of characters that surrounded him and his parents and some of his relations and all the rest of it, and some of the sort of icons of the time. But he'll give equal billing to the man that ran the fishing tackle shop. His father was addicted to fly fishing and they ate trout every other night for supper. But he'll give equal billing to one of these people that work on the waterways in rural Wiltshire, as he will to the Prime Minister at the time, Harold Macmillan, all that sort of thing. So it's a very unusual, lopsided. People that know Jonathan Mead's writing will know that it's exciting, dazzlingly written, and exceptionally lopsided as well.
That sounds very good as well. And before I let you go, we still have one book. I believe it's about literary history of some sort.
Yeah, so this is called The Shivago Affair. It's by Peter Finn and Petra Cuvée. And this is a fascinating story. Obviously, everybody knows Dr. Shivago, the novel by Boris Pasternak, and they know it was turned in very famously to a film by David Lean. And it's the background to how that novel came to be. It was suppressed by the Soviets when it was written. Pasternak was brought up in Moscow during the revolution and writes, and as you know, the story of Dr. Shivago is pretty unsympathetic to the revolution and how it was done. Maybe not the revolution itself, but how it was done. Maybe the revolution, the Bolshevik rather than the Mensheviks is his specific thing, perhaps. And that's what the Shivago affair is about, how an Italian publisher smuggled it out of Russia and gave it to an American to sort of publish it. The CIA got their hands on it. And then basically this banned book in Russia was then distributed, was published, printed and distributed with the great help of the CIA, so that Russians or Soviets came to read this novel, which was banned and only really because of CIA intervention. And this very gutsy, ballsy Milanese publisher as well. And Pasternak obviously basked in the glory of this thing, but he was slightly nervous about getting this novel published in his home country and basically being put up against a wall and shot for it. But it's a fantastic novel of it's a novel about revolutions and about the difficulty of them, but the way that this book about that novel is written is almost like a spy story. So it's a really fascinating thing. There are some slightly clunky sentences in it. It's not the most elegantly written book, perhaps, and I won't do the authors any disservice by saying that, but it's a rip-roaring page turner and a fantastic and important piece of literary history.
Well, I definitely know which books I'm buying tomorrow when I'm heading to my flight to go to Finland for the weekend. That was Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound with three book recommendations for this week. Thank you very much. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Owen and Matthew Jameson. Today's show was produced by Daniel Cercapelli, researched by Alex Afermanish and Michaela Aitken. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Next after the headlines is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Then at 2200 hours is The Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
From London to Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.